Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, afoxolaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
If your small business is booming, you might say,
cha-ching!
But you should say,
like a good neighbor, State Farm is there!
And we'll help your growing business. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Welcome to Fantasy Feud, a pitcherless baseball podcast where we're tackling the most relevant debates in fantasy baseball each week. I'm Sarah Sanchez, and I am back with my co-host, the one and only Shelley Verstrate, to talk through both sides of some of the hottest fantasy baseball debates right now. It is June, y'all. We are making decisions and trying to win our leagues. It was a bit of an SOS weekend in FAB for me, and the injuries just kept coming. This JT Realmuto news is hitting me super hard on Monday, or on Tuesday as we're recording. I wish I would have known that yesterday. Shelley, how are you and how are your teams?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. I'm still trying to catch up with all of like these prospects that came up like over the weekend. I was kind of offline, and then I log in on Sunday to start doing my FAB, and I'm like, oh my goodness, everyone is basically getting promoted. That's pretty cool. So, you know, just trying to work through that, and then just trying to, you know, tackle certain specific categories in some of my leagues during FAB. So it's, you know, it's just that mid-season grind right now.
It is. And it was a huge weekend for prospects. We're going to talk about some of them with some of our debates today. But before we jump into those debates, we're excited to welcome Eric Samulski to the show. You know Eric from his work at NBC Sports and Roto World. And of course, you know him as the co-host of Pitcherless Own on the Quarter. Thanks for joining us today. How's it going, Eric?
It's going well. Thank you both for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, we're super stoked to have you on the show. Just a reminder for anyone who might be new, this is a debate podcast, so we do things a little bit differently over here at Fantasy Feud. Everything is a series of mini debates. Each debater will get 3 minutes to make their case. And there's a question and answer period that can be questions from the moderators or questions from the debaters to each other. And then we'll wrap it up with quick 1 minute rebuttals. That's it. Like, we're just debating these things out and hoping that you get some more information to make the best fantasy baseball decisions that you can along the way. And it looks like Shelley has our first debate today, so I am going to pass the mic to her.
Yeah, I'm going to be leading off like Kyle Schwarber, right? I'm going to hit a home run right out the park. So super subs with super value. So Luis Ranjifo has been a $14.90 player over on FanGraphs this year. But maybe as more importantly, he's eligible pretty much everywhere. He's got second base, he's got third base, he's got shortstop, he's got outfield. And I just want to just have y'all just like hash it out here. Do we adequately value multi-position eligibility during draft prep season and all of that? I'll shoot it over to Eric first since he's our guest.
I'm going to say we overvalue it. And since I have my 3 minutes here, I will say we overvalue it in the sense that it is important for sure. Having that positional flexibility, having the ability to move somebody around in your lineup so you can fill something when somebody has a day off or is injured or whatever. In particular, if you're in a move with like a league with like daily lineup moves, it's incredibly valuable to have that person that you can move around. I think that we sometimes in draft season overvalue it to the extent that we take players who maybe have moderate value and give them more value because of their multi-positions. I'm looking at the guys who are really, within the top even like 100 on the FanGraphs player rater as of right now. And I think that they're all players where like they're not more valuable if I'm going to use them because I can use them other places, right? Like Alec Bohm, first base, third base. He's the 33rd player on the FanGraphs player rater. To me, the first base, third base, like that doesn't make him more valuable. Yes, I can move him around, but he's a player I'm keeping in my lineup regardless, I guess I could roster other players. You know, I could have had Rafael Devers and then move Bohm to first. Somebody like Ha-Seong Kim. Yeah, his value is tied in his 14 stolen bases. You know, you have the ability to move him around and keep him in the lineup. I think those things are, they're important, but I think if you were to draft Ha-Seong Kim and he was just shortstop eligible, like you're planning your roster around that and you are finding other players that you can draft and he's not coming out of your lineup. He's staying in there. He's playing most days. I think it has value, but I think too often we look at, you know, guys like maybe in the back half, oh, Sadan Rafael was going to pick up multiple positions. Oh, Willie Castro plays all over the place. Oh, if you're in Yahoo formats, Justin Turner had three, you know, positions. Whit Merrifield, second base, outfield. I think that the guys who tend to get the most value being multi-position guys tend to be guys who are probably top 150 players anyway. But in the draft, we take players who are on that back half and we really bump them up into like the middle rounds because we're like, oh, they have more positions. Well, Willie Castro's giving you no production no matter what position you're playing him at right now. So it doesn't really matter if you drafted him to move him all over. You should be moving him to your bench or the waiver wire.
Yeah, I definitely hear that. Sarah, I really want to know what you think about this. Do you think that we are overvaluing this during draft season or what? What do you think?
So I actually think we undervalue multi-position eligibility because I think that these players generally get put in order as to whatever their like hardest position to fill is. So in the case of a Luis Renjifo, he's probably being valued as a third base option or a shortstop option, right? Maybe not so much as an outfielder second base option. But I think I was just looking at this. I went back and looked at my player values from draft season specifically with Renjifo because he is saving me in a handful of leagues this year. That's a player who went, at least when I was drafting, like in the mid 240s, somewhere around there, and he was valued as like a $5, $5.50 player. Now, admittedly, a bunch of his value this year has changed from how the Angels are approaching their running game. So, like, they're not all Luis Renjifo, right? Like, Eric is absolutely right. For every Luis Renjifo that's out there, there's also a Whit Merrifield out there, and you're not getting that same sort of value from Whit Merrifield. But the guys that you can take early in your draft, I think they do two things for you on draft. They do one thing for you on draft day, and they do a different thing for you when you're playing out your season. On draft day, they give you the ability to say, I currently have a guy who is either a second baseman, a third baseman, a shortstop, or an outfielder. That means that when that next position comes up, I can take the best of any one of those positions, and I don't have to worry about not having the other one filled. I did this frequently in draft season with Nico Horner, who was going in generally like the fourth to seventh round, depending on where you were at, because he was either a second baseman or he was a shortstop. But that meant when I had to take my next second base or shortstop guy, I could just go with wherever the draft board was taking me. And I wasn't locked in to, I can't take that guy because I already have a second baseman. I think that's a real beauty of a player like a Ha-Seong Kim or a Nico Horner. What they're doing for you during the season, though, and I don't think this is baked into their value, and this is why I think we do need to push these players up a little bit, is Luis Renjifo has saved me in Glarf like five times this year because I can slot him in when somebody else gets hurt, right? So right now he's in my lineup for Nico Horner, who has a hand fracture. And that means that I can move Otto Lopez to that middle infield spot and I can just play somebody else in the outfield. That super sub ability makes it a lot easier for me to then, when I'm looking at the waiver wire, value and get the players that I really want, rather than needing a specific position because I have a guy who can play four of them. Now, I do want to hat tip something that Eric said here that I think is totally on point. There's a big difference between these guys who are very good players early or in the middle part of a draft versus the guy that you're taking in the last round. I don't think you're getting a ton of value necessarily for a guy you're taking in like the 24th round because he has second base and outfield eligibility. I'm looking at you, Jeff McNeil. I think you are getting value though when you can make, when it can impact those decisions later and you can say, I've got a Nico Horner that gives me flexibility. I've got a Luis Renjifo that gives me flexibility. I've got a Spencer Steer. Do I have a first baseman? Do I have an outfielder? I don't know, but I have someone I can plug in either of those spots and that means I can take the other one later.
Yeah, Eric, Sarah brings up a great point. Taking these guys in a draft gives you just a little bit extra flexibility, you know, first base, third base, second base, outfields. Do you think that maybe we're not thinking about that? Or do you think that's an advantage, disadvantage? What do you think?
So I fully agree with what Sarah said. I guess in my head, when I'm thinking about that situation that she's talking about, particularly like Mookie Betts was a perfect example where, like, if you're at the fifth overall pick, and this was when the top four picks seemed to be kind of like consensus. We'll talk about one of those players later on in the show. But like, you're like, okay, I'll take Mookie Betts because I know that he's a very valuable player. I know he's a first round hitter. Maybe he should go seventh. I'll take him fifth. Maybe he should go eighth. I'll take him fifth because now I can just let the board fall to me wherever it happens. And so I think it makes a lot of sense what Sarah's saying with those early round picks. I guess in my head, those aren't players I'm really valuing because of their multi-position eligibility. Maybe I am subconsciously, because we're talking about it right now, I'm giving them value because of that. I guess I'm looking at it like the players who I view when I approached this conversation, I was looking at players whose value tends to stem from they're being multi-position guys, the guys who seem to have like three or four spots, you know, behind their name, or we look at them and say, hey, this guy's like, the first thing we think of is the value is multi-position, right? Not the value is he's Mookie Betts, right? Or the value of, you know, Nico Horner is, sorry, Sarah, that it's not coming to fruition, but you're getting 40 stolen bases or whatever, right? Like, so I think everything Sarah said is right. And I think, you know, maybe bumping them up a couple of spots in those early rounds. Like if you have the player ranked 40th, well, maybe somewhere in the upper 30s, in the early 30s makes sense. You're bumping them a little bit. I just think it is counterbalanced by the way that we sometimes push up. You mentioned perfectly Jeff McNeil, like players like that, where we're taking a profile that doesn't have a lot of value and saying, but I can move him around, and then you're attributing value to that, but there's no, like, the player needs to have value on his own, and then the multi-position can bump it up, as opposed to the multi-position just providing all of the value.
Yeah, I mean, I totally get that. I mean, this year in some of my, you know, 50 round drafts, I have Jeff McNeil, and it's awful. I don't like it. But last year I had Luis Rangifo and it didn't go well for me. So Sarah, what Eric said is it worth taking these maybe not high caliber guys, even though they have extra positional flexibility in these like 50 round drafts? Like, is it worth it? Because I'm not feeling it with Jeff McNeil. Maybe that's totally my fault there.
I mean, I will be the first one to admit these players are not all created equally. And like a few years ago, you were really happy if you had Jeff McNeil and you had second base and outfield eligibility and he was winning a batting title, right? And that was helping you in a ton of ways. This year, that's probably not helping you nearly as much. But I'm just kind of looking down the list. And like I said, I pulled up my player values. This is what I used for the GLARF draft, for the record. So this is probably like mid-February, and these moved a little bit. But I'm looking at some of the guys you could have taken right around Luis Rangifo or a little bit before. JD Martinez, who didn't have a team, UT only, goes right there. Ryan Mountcastle, first base, goes right there. Robert Stevenson, pitcher, who didn't wind up really pitching, but at the time we thought he could be a closer, goes right there. Tyler Stevenson, catcher. Jonathan India, second base. Carlos Correa, shortstop. I would take, and did take, Luis Rangifo above that entire crew, because frankly, I think the existence of like all of those positions alone pushes him above a guy who's UT only for me, a guy like JD Martinez, or a guy who might be the closer, but might not be the closer, and we're not really sure. However, the player that I think Eric brought up in his answer that I think exemplifies this perfectly for me is Mookie Betts, because when I thought Mookie Betts was going to be an outfielder with second base eligibility, I thought he was a top five pick. When I heard he was going to play shortstop, he became, in my mind, the second pick overall. Like, I would have taken Mookie 1.2, no questions asked. The only guy I might have considered taking instead 1.2 is Spencer Strider, and that wouldn't have worked out for me, but I think the process was still good, so I will die on that hill. But Mookie having shortstop, second base, and outfield, being able to hit, you know, 330 for you and go 30-30, bumps him above a Bobby Witt Jr. for me, period, the end. Like, I think when you're comparing those two players, I'd rather have the guy that I can slot into three positions in case someone gets hurt.
I think it's so interesting you meant that we're doing this with Renhifo, because I think the narrative on Renhifo coming into the year, and this is my recollection of it, and I drafted him a few places because I believed in this narrative, is, okay, here's a guy who hit 264 with 16 homers last year. The plate discipline stats were pretty good. The batted ball stats were pretty good. There's a chance on this team he gets full-time at bats. What if he hits, you know, 270, 20 home runs, steals, you know, 10, 15 bags was kind of the thought. But like, he's going to accumulate a lot of stats. I think the value that you've gotten from him is, A, he's moved up to second in the order, which was a hope, but not necessarily something locked in. And when Ron Washington said the Angels were going to run, he really meant the Angels were going to run. And I don't know that any of us anticipated that. So Renhifo has been great. And because he has value and you can move him all around, that is incredibly helpful for you. I wonder if that's like a little bit of the outlier in the debate, because what he's been doing on the field is so different than what we expected coming in terms of where he's getting that value, like the value from heavy stolen bases. And I would argue that even, you know, like the biggest Renhifo supporters weren't thinking he was hitting like 320. And he probably won't as the season goes on. But, you know, there is a lot of value in what he's doing, but he would still have that value even if he was just second base eligible. And I understand that the strategy behind it, and I totally agree that like as a tiebreaker or as like a maybe a one round bump, those sort of things are meaningful. But I think, like I mentioned, that the value has to stand on its own. I love that you brought up Mountcastle, who happens to be the 41st ranked player on the player radar ahead of Luis Renhifo. And if you had said, looking back, like, would you rather have Mountcastle than Renhifo? I really do think it depends on your roster, your team, right? Like there are probably a lot of situations where you'd rather have Renhifo because you can move him all around. But you may also have drafted, you know, Austin Riley, who's giving you no power. And you're like, 11 home runs for Mountcastle is really good for me right now. And so, like, that's where I think the multi-position thing is great and it brings value, but there are still, it doesn't necessarily always vault the player above, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think that you're right, that it's not for assured. And like the Nico Horner example is a really good example of this. And my kingdom for the Cubs to start running again. What are we doing in the city of Chicago? Please run more. They did actually start running a little bit more in the month of May, but it hasn't really trickled all the way down to Nico yet. I'm still holding out some hope here that once he gets healthy, he'll start running. However, it doesn't always work out, right? Like if you bumped a Nico Horner or Ha-Seong Kim, you're probably not happy about that decision. But if you bumped Mookie Betts, you're pretty happy about it. If you bumped Renhifo, you're pretty happy about it. I definitely agree with you. It depends on what you need. I have found, and Jason Collette was on the show a while back, like the power outage that has happened early on this season in the league. If you bumped home run guys instead of stolen base guys, you're probably really happy with that because you can find stolen bases on the waiver wire and you can't find power on the waiver wire. That's a decision I made in a couple of leagues that I'm super happy about. And so it's a really good case for, hey, Mountcastle over Renhifo might have worked out better for you. That said, I always want, and maybe this is just a me thing, I always want one of those guys on my team. I want a Spencer Steer. I want a Luis Renhifo. I'm not making every single draft pick that way. But if I can get myself a Matt McClain early, and admittedly, again, didn't work out because he's hurt, but that second base shortstop flexibility is a nice extra when you're looking at, am I going to take Matt McClain or am I going to take Xander Bogaerts?
For sure.
Well, I think Xander probably has both now too, so that's a bad example, but he didn't on draft day.
But no, I fully support that. I think we've kind of like ended this debate by kind of agreeing, like coming to the middle somewhere.
Well, let me ask you a question, Eric, because I do have one follow-up question here. And this is what I'm thinking about this debate and like, do we undervalue or overvalue? I'm thinking of the auction calculator, like literal values and the values in the player radar. There's nothing there that gives you an extra dollar or two because you play four slots and you can fill a corner or a middle, right?
And I know Tanner Bell, I use the SGP sheet a lot, and I know that Tanner Bell has talked about how like some people bump up plate appearances as a way of trying to like approximate, hey, this person will play more positions and I need to give them a little more value. And he said that like in testing that didn't really work. I don't know that they have landed on a good way to approximate it, but yes, I agree with you. When I go through my rankings and I look at like what does the SGP data spit out, I tend to then say, okay, I may adjust manually a little bit for a player who I think as like a super util type of guy is going to give me that extra flexibility. And I think it's like, again, I'd rather trust the guys who have done it and shown it. I'm thinking now, like every time I look back at like what we did in the draft, it was guys we were saying, oh, they're going to pick up extra eligibility. So like Sal Frelick was going to play all over the field before Garrett Mitchell got hurt. And there was going to be extra value there. I already mentioned Sadon Rafaela, who, you know, is shortstop and outfield. And that's really valuable because you can move that player all around. And there have been moments where you're happy you had him, but it hasn't been great. And so the placing the value onto them because of like what we think we're going to get. I think it's hard to figure out exactly how much value when you're doing your like auctions or your rankings or however you're doing your draft prep. Is like, I don't know that there is a surefire like bump this guy up 10 spots and that's multi-position, because I just don't know that, like as we're talking about it, I don't know that there's this equal level of value.
No, it's a great point. And you know, I always wonder too, does the position change it? Because one guy who I thought was going to get a huge value bump or that you should bump around because he was going to pick up a position was Christopher Morel picking up third base. Mm-hmm. That's partially because third base is not a great position to fill at that point in the draft. Like Morel is being drafted as an outfielder. There's not a third baseman who's going to hit you potentially 35 home runs at that position. So when he picks up third base, if you had an Austin Riley from earlier, now you've just got a third baseman who can make up that power differential, right? Mm-hmm. But I agree, this is probably more case by case, and it's probably not something that can be spit out on a spreadsheet easily.
Yeah, I think like also you're adding up the positions, right? So like somebody who's second base, third base, like a Ryan McMahon. Well, Ryan McMahon is second base, third base, middle, corner. That's four spots, right? Somebody like Rafaela is shortstop and outfield. So shortstop, middle, outfield. So it's like one less position. Those you can start. Then you're like really getting into the weeds of like, how much am I really going to elevate this player? And it just becomes, it's so hard. And that's where I think it is a little bit of like the get your guy thing, where like, if you think that player has value, and if you truly believe that player has value because he can move around, then sure, bump him up. But it should be because you also value the player, not because you're thinking, well, he's going to give me flexibility. If that's all you think he's going to give you, it's probably not worth it.
Good stuff. I think we out-rebuttaled ourselves here, but that was a great conversation. And I'm glad we kept going with it. Well, because the flip side of this conversation is something that is not on today's debate slate, but maybe we can debate it some other time, which is the guys who are UT only, right? Like, because I always find myself, I'm like, oh man, I can't take Shohei Ohtani in the first round. He's UT only. Like I'm filling my UT spot way too early, but that is a debate for another day. I think I have the moderating duties for the next debate, so I'm just going to lead us right into it. It's been unbelievably tough to find saves on the waiver wire this season. In fact, I was looking at the Fangraphs player rater, and eight of the 18 guys who have at least 10 saves, only two of them were waiver wire pickups this season, in Foley and McGill. It's June. We don't have a lot of prospects for guys with saves coming up either. If you're short in a league where you are competitive and your save situation is dire, is it time to punt? Is it time to spec on some guys who might pick up a job when somebody gets traded? What is your plan if you're short on saves? And Shelley, we'll start with you.
Yeah. As someone who is short on saves in a couple of leagues, if there's not an overall component, like we're not talking like main event, we're not talking NFB OC, we're not talking any of that. If you just want to go for your league, this is just your home league, whatever, and you're like at this point, I don't know, 10 saves below the next highest. So if you're last, so in a 12 team, like if you 11th is like 10 saves, you know, above you. But you can move up, and for some reason, you can move up in strikeouts. You can move up in wins or something. totally punt it. Just go for it. At this point, you're so far behind. Just go for what you can do to make yourself better in a league. And if that means just punting saves and not having to worry about the closer carousel, you're probably going to feel better because the closer carousel is awful every single Sunday. I hate riding it. If you can see an avenue to move up in your league and it's punting, punt that football.
Or baseball, or saves, as the case may be. I'm with you. I mean, I have a couple of places, admittedly, where there's not an overall component where I'm just like, whatever, I guessed wrong, and I'm so far back on saves that I need to do something else. Eric, what about you? What's your strategy when you're down on a category like saves and we're, you know, staring 2+ months into the season at reality?
Everything Shelly said makes sense logically, and I still would try not to punt. And part of that is twofold. One, it's knowing your strengths, and I historically have not been good at punting categories. Whether it's because I don't execute the strategy properly, you know, I try to do it maybe going into a draft and I don't get it, or I punt when I think there's actually value, or I punt on saves, but I'm not picking up enough value in other places with the spots that I would have used on saves, whatever it is. I know that I struggle when I'm punting a category. So I have to take in my own skills as a player when I'm making these decisions, is like, should I punt saves? If I was strategically maybe more adept at making that move, it might be an easier call to punt saves. I need to try to make sure I'm not putting myself in a situation where I'm going to totally torpedo my team. I also think the interesting thing with saves is how, like, I know it says how quickly it is to make up, but it's more the idea that, like, we understand the math behind saves, right? Like, it is just literally just adding the numbers up on top of it. And so, like, I logically can think, if I were to get, if I'm 7, 8, 9 saves out of rising up points, like, that's not a lot of time. That's a hot couple of weeks. That's, you know, somebody gets traded and a spot opens up and all of a sudden, you know, I now have a closer. And even if that closer gets me 12 saves at the end of the year, that's 12 that I didn't have before. If I also execute a trade and get another closer who gives me 10 saves, that's 22 more saves than I had. And that doesn't take a lot to manufacture that. And so for me, even though there hasn't been a carousel right now in terms of, like, lots of guys losing their jobs and gaining their jobs, like, we know that that could change at any moment because pitcher injuries happen, trades happen. I'm inclined to not fully punt saves before the deadline. I'm looking at, like, around right now, and it wouldn't surprise me if the A's traded Mason Miller. I don't think they should, because they need to have one player that people really want to root for. Like, the Red Sox are almost definitely trading Kenley Jansen and Chris Martin. I don't trust Jordan Romano's elbow. I know he's throwing again, but, like, sure. Jason Foley could get traded and hasn't looked particularly good. There's no reason the Nationals should hold on to Kyle Finnegan. He's like 33 years old and they're rebuilding. Tanner Scott is definitely going to get traded. So, like, right off the top of your head, you're rattling off, what was that, like, 6 jobs that could open in the next month. So I really do think it is looking at your standings and seeing how far out of it you really are. Because sometimes even if you gain 4 points, like, that's still 4 points you didn't have before. And in a roto league, that could make a big difference if you're not making drastic sacrifices to your other categories. Like, picking up one spec guy off the waiver wire, you know, could help me gain a couple points. I'm not, you know, dropping a really great hitter. I'm not saying, you know, trade away Tyler Glasnow to get a closer, you know, just little moves up the standings.
It is interesting, some of the guys that you named, Eric, who are struggling that maybe we don't have a ton of faith in, right? Like, if your safe situation is dependent on Tanner Scott right now, he's probably not a closer wherever he gets traded when he gets traded. Right. Similarly, I have Jordan Romano in a handful of places, and I don't feel great about that right now. I really wish that past me picked up Yimmy Garcia the first time Jordan Romano was on the shelf, and then dropped Yimmy Garcia, and now I'm in a mess because I didn't get Yimmy Garcia back. So good job past me losing those saves all over the place. But I think you're absolutely right. It's a volatile position. Like, it's a place where there's a small number of saves that are going to make the difference. If you can get 12 of them later, you can get four or five standings points there. I'm curious, how early, Eric, are you making those decisions to go after some of those spec guys? And how, and if you're in a situation like the NFBC where you don't really have injured spots or a deep bench, you can really only keep one of those guys hanging around for a few months, right?
Yeah. So I think now is when I would start looking to go after them. I mean, you know, we got the trade deadline in, what is it, like six weeks, 7 weeks, something like their math. And so, you know, you might start seeing moves in the next 2-3 weeks, the players that are the most logical to be moved. I think if you are thinking about punting saves, that means you don't really have closers on your roster. So instead of rostering, you know, maybe you've been picking up extra starters, maybe you've been rostering, you know, guys like, you know, who we'll talk about later, but guys like Matt Strom or Jeremiah Estrada or Ryan Yarbrough, if you're in deeper leagues, where you're like, I'm going to get innings and wins. I think, like, why not take a couple of those spots and spec on somebody who, you know, why not add Hunter Harvey? Yeah, sure, he could get traded, but if he doesn't and Finnegan gets traded, he's in a closer role. Why not add Justin Slayton? He's pitching pretty well for the Red Sox, and if they were to move both Kenley Jansen and Chris Martin, which is feasible, then he, you know, could pick up saves. And so, like, I think there's no harm in stashing a couple of those guys if you're in this situation, because you're not cutting, like, really valuable closers to begin with. And if you're cutting a starter, like, at that point, if all you have are starters, you're not going to use those guys all the time. You're just basically cycling out a streamer for a spec closer. And I think that's totally fair to do, but I wouldn't, like, fill up your team, you know, five spec guys and hope that, like, two of them hit and all of a sudden you're going to vault to the top. Like, you know, take a couple of gambles and see if it pays off. And it doesn't, then, you know, they didn't get the job and you're right back to punting saves again. And, you know, you're not picking up a bad reliever hoping he closes. You're picking up a good reliever hoping he gets a job. And so hopefully you've at least gotten decent ratios and maybe a sneaky win or two in the meantime.
Yeah, and you can always punt your saves later, although that gave you lost, you know, those 4 to 6 weeks where you could have been trying to accumulate some of those counting stats like strikeouts or wins. Shelly, the question I have for you relates to something we talked about on the show last week, which is two-star pitchers. I wonder how much of this is balancing the category you're trying to punt with volume, but also protecting the ratios. Because I find that with pitching categories in particular, once you get into the game of, like, I'm just trying to get strikeouts and wins, your ratios can tank really fast.
Yeah, they can. But you can also try to spec for a closer and pick up Reed Garrett and have him just totally blow up for like 2 to 3 weeks. So it's for me, it's famine or famine. Like, I cannot get the balance right. But yeah, I totally see where Eric is coming from, because any type of gain, any type of points gain can help you in a, you know, a roto sense. But I don't know. I've had trouble the last couple of seasons picking the right guy. I mean, I had Hunter Harvey last year, and Kyle Finnegan is still sticking around. Jason Adam helped me a little bit last year, but didn't quite take the job because, I mean, Pete Fairbanks is great, but I was expecting maybe a little bit more saves here and there. And it's just like, just trying to project teams who we think might trade someone because they should is kind of a little bit hard to do, because teams are funny and they don't do what you think that they're going to do. So I like, if I'm so far behind where I have feasibly no chance, just punt it now and get started on racking up those, hopefully racking up those Ks and wins.
All right. Good stuff from both of you. I think we are due for some rebuttals. So Eric, I'm going to go to you for our first rebuttal.
It's funny that I guess I don't really have a rebuttal. Let's see. What would I disagree with from what Shelly said, which is I guess just, I'm curious, I guess more of a question than a rebuttal, but if you are, do we know that punting categories mid-season, right, when you haven't like drafted as that plan, do we actually know that it gives you a surefire better chance of winning a league? I know you're talking about not doing an overall, but like you're sacrificing points that could be out there that you had originally intended to get. So you're not saying, hey, this is the spot in the draft where I would take a closer. Instead, I'm going to take a really good hitter. And so I'm racking up offensive production to counter that. You're basically just looking at like who's on the waiver wire and saying, instead of trying to add a closer, I'm going to try to add a hitter. So it's all risky value, right? It's all nebulous, hypothetical value. So are we sure that from like a strategic and from like a, you know, a calculated standpoint, that that actually gives you a better chance of winning the league than saying, why don't I just try to get 2 points from saves?
I mean, I'm sure someone has done that research, but yeah, definitely someone more smarter than me. But at least for me, it helps me out on Sunday. I don't have to worry about that category. I can focus on the other categories. I don't have to worry about, oh, where is this, you know, eighth inning guy? Is he, you know, maybe did he get like a couple saves? Is there kind of like some type of movement going on there? I can focus on other stuff instead of focusing on everything else, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. And I think that peace of mind is also really important for fantasy purposes too. I'll say also to your, you didn't mention it specifically, but you're alluding to it, which is like, maybe it's saving those dollars, right? Like by not specking on closers, you're maybe just saving money that can be valuable toward hitters. So that's an interesting thing to think about as well.
Yeah. Well, the thing I was going to say, and just to jump in for 1 second, is I feel like you can pick up, you can stream starting pitchers way cheaper than you can pick up the guy who's next in line for saves, unless you're super early on a saves call and you're right. And I, the number of times I'm right on that is it's not very good.
Exactly.
All right. Good stuff. We are overdue for a break for our sponsor. So we are going to take a quick break, but don't go anywhere. We've got some great debates coming back, looking at some of the prospects who were picked up over the weekend and what we think is going to happen with them. Plus our love it or leave it. So stick around. All right. We're back for this next debate. I believe that Shelley is our moderator.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
Hey, go-getters. Let Noom Sport Hydration Tablets power up your fun and keep you ready to move. Simply drop, dissolve, and enjoy crisp and refreshing flavors like strawberry lemonade or lemon lime. With 5 essential electrolytes and crafted with clean, non-GMO, vegan, and gluten-free ingredients, Noom should be your go-to hydration choice. Because when you're hydrated, you can do more, go further, and recover quicker. Shop now on NoonLife.com and get ready for endless fun, because anything can happen after noon.
Dogs are an important part of our lives. That means protecting them from parasites. Ask your vet about NexGard Plus, Afoxolaner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection against fleas, ticks, heartworm disease, roundworms, and hookworms. Plus, they're delicious and easy to give. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive. Ask about NexGard Plus Chews.
Keep your space feeling comfortable this summer with help from Menards. The Denali Air 6000 BTU window air conditioner has a 3-speed cooling system with remote control, allowing you to control the temperature of your space from anywhere in the room. You call the shots with auto and eco mode to maximize performance and save on energy costs. Stop by in-store or online at Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Yeah, the ex-prospect person is going to be moderating this debate. So this should be fun. I'm kidding. So we had, like we've been alluding all podcasts, there was like a humongous amount of prospects that were called up this weekend. It was very exciting. I mean, prospects, like new players into the player pool, and then just watching them in a game is absolutely fun. But we're going to talk about some prospect pitchers. So we're going to do a pick your fighter, pick your starter kind of conversation here. Between we got Max Meyer and Hurston Waldrop. So we got a Marlin and we got a Brave. So it's an NL East battle. Sarah, we'll go with you.
So this, and full disclosure, there was another fighter that I almost picked instead of Hurston Waldrop. And so I just want to give a shout out to DJ Hertz, who also made his debut over the weekend. Former Cubs minor league pitcher of the year, has a wicked changeup. And I love the situation he finds himself in that Nationals rotation, because that is a rotation that has been looking for talent all season long. And so I feel like DJ Hertz is like my runner up here. But my guy today is going to be Hurston Waldrop, who honestly didn't have the best start coming out for Atlanta his first time through. It was kind of ugly, and maybe you got a discount on him for that. And if you did, you'll probably be happy about it later. The thing I like about Hurston Waldrop is he's one of these guys who's coming up relatively early. He's only 22 years old. He's kind of he shot through the minor leagues last year the same way that AJ Smith-Shaver did, the same way we saw Spencer Strider do it. And we know that the Braves have had some success with this before. So you're looking at a guy who's got big strikeout potential, who the Braves believe is ready. He pitches for a great team that's going to give him a ton of run support. As long as he can go five innings and give you some of those strikeout numbers and give you some of that win potential, I think Hurston Waldrop is going to be a guy that we want in our rotations a month from now. I thought it was going to be AJ Smith-Shaver, but unfortunately he's on the IL. And so Hurston Waldrop is basically the same type of prospect in terms of pedigree and in terms of what you're getting. Lots of strikeouts, win potential, and we've seen this movie from the Braves before, and we know it can work. So Hurston Waldrop, come on down and get me some of those W's, because they're almost as hard to find as saves.
Yeah, Waldrop was kind of like a sneaky guy that the Braves got in the back half of the first round last year. Like, everyone loved his slider. And I mean, at least like his first game, like the pitching plus grades were pretty good on that slider. But yeah, it didn't quite turn out too well against the Nationals. Eric, so what good things do you have to say about a Marlins guy?
Yeah, so my fighter here is Max Meyer. And I will say, respect to Sarah's fighter, who I also enjoy, and I picked up in a few non-FBC places where I could. And I think the start was actually, again, better than the box score indicates. Why I prefer Max Meyer is twofold. One, we've seen him perform at the MLB level already. So we know that he can. The strikeouts weren't there in his first three starts this year, but the performance was strong. And so I feel a little bit of that baseline comfort with just, he's been at this level, he's performed at this level, he's done it. These are both guys with a truly elite pitch. For Waldrop, it's the splitter. For Meyer, it's the slider. I trust Meyer's slider a little bit more, because I think he commands it a little bit better than Waldrop commands the splitter, but because, again, splitters by nature. I know that this is, as a pitcherless podcast, we have to make sure that, you know, Nick, we're touting what Nick says, is that sliders or splitters as a primary pitch are really difficult to handle, because pitchers can lose feel of them. They're not pitches that are designed to be thrown four strikes. So I think Meyer's main offering being a slider makes me feel a little bit better about their A number one plus pitches. They're both pitches that they can use to hitters of both handedness. They're both pitches that induce big swings and misses. The tiebreaker here for me is Max Meyer has better command of his fastball. I think it makes his fastball better. Hurston Waldrop has better velocity on the fastball. But the fastball doesn't have great movement and shape. And his, like, wild mechanics, he's kind of very max effort delivery, makes it hard for him to pinpoint the location on that fastball. And so I look at Myers four seamer. And I'm like, okay, it's not a great pitch, but he had a 20% called strike rate with it early on in the season. Decent CSW marks. He throws it in the zone often. It grades out well in PLV because of the locations. He utilizes it better than Waldrop does. And so I think that gives him a better baseline foundation for success. And I think we are overvaluing Max Meyer's AAA stats right now. I tend to not look at AAA stats when especially pitchers get sent down in the middle of the season, because they're often sent down to work on things. And so they're working on things and they're trying to get better at those particular things, and the results won't always be there. Max Meyer has also publicly mentioned that being sent down mentally was something he needed to kind of grapple with and wrap his head around. And so those early starts were not particularly good. Also, they're throwing in three innings at a time as a starting pitcher. I'm sure that is not great. However, I don't think Max Meyer is going seven innings a start when he comes up to the big leagues, the point of sending him down and throwing him three innings at a time, at least what the Marlins have said publicly, was so that they could bring him up and get him innings at the big league level. I don't think they're going to bring him up just to keep throwing him three innings at a time. The plan was to limit the innings so he gets them over the summer. So I still don't know that you're getting more than five or six innings out of him, but I think you're getting that. I don't think you're getting three or four. And so I do think there's a little bit more of a safety there. And also I'll save this for my rebuttal, because it's a knock on Waldrop. So I'll hold on to it.
Oh, geez, that's a little tease right there. Sarah, so another thing about Waldrop, like during, you know, when he was being drafted, like Eric said, he's high effort. And a lot of evaluators thought that he was going to end up being a high leverage reliever, because just he only has basically like two pitches, really. It's high effort. It looks reliever-ish. That being said, does that affect your thought for him for this year?
It doesn't. And I just want to preview one of the reasons that I picked Waldrop over Meyer here. I really like Max Meyer, by the way. I had Max Meyer in a handful of places. He was somebody I speculated on in draft season. I have him in like two draft and holds. And I was pretty furious with the way the Marlins treated him by sending him back to AAA and doing this three innings at a time thing. And it reminded me a little bit of how we all got super excited about Yuri Perez last year, and then the Marlins were like, nope, we're just going to like hit pause on this. And we're like, what are we doing? And it didn't even work. Like, Yuri Perez is injured. So it didn't even like save him the injury or anything else. What it comes down to for me, I trust the Braves to handle Waldrop more than I trust the Marlins to handle Meyer. And the last few starts that Waldrop had in the minors, who's already getting stretched out, he's already going the 5 to 6 innings. Like, Meyer hasn't done that in a while. And I don't know what the Marlins are going to do with that. I don't know if he's going to have those win opportunities, both because the team is bad, but also because of the way they're treating his innings, as if there's some, the Marlins act like they have some like clock talk, like tracking all these innings, and somehow they just know it expires at the stroke of midnight at 95 or something. And I don't think that's how pitching works. And I don't think that's how wins work. And I worry about being able to get those W's with Max Meyer, even though I like him as a pitcher for all the reasons that Eric said, maybe better than I like Kirsten Waldrop. I think the Braves are going to let him get wins. And I think as a result of those extra innings, he's also going to get more strikeouts. The two pitch thing. We saw this from Spencer Strider. We saw this from Justin Steele. We saw this recently from Ben Brown. You can absolutely play as a two pitch pitcher in the major leagues if your stuff is good enough. And I think Waldrop's stuff is good enough.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Eric, what do you think about like the team context? Because Sarah, again, brings up a great point. Braves versus Marlins. Yeah.
So that's my rebuttal, actually. And I will say, in just to Sarah's point, in defense of Waldrop, I don't think he's a two-pitch pitcher. I think the slider has actually gotten a lot better this year, and I think the slider could be a legitimate plus secondary pitch. My concern is I don't love when the worst pitch is the foundational pitch, which is the fastball, the pitch that you have to be like, I need to get this over the plate. I need to, you know, to get a strike. And I think like what you saw in that game was like, in a lot of the 3-2 counts, he went to off-speed pitches. And it's not necessarily in the sense we were like, ooh, that's great. He has so much confidence in that pitch. I think it was like, he's like, I'm not throwing this fastball in a 3-2 count because I don't trust it. My rebuttal to Sarah on the team context is I still think the Braves, despite the Acuna injury, have World Series aspirations. And I think if a trade possibility opens up for them to add a reliable starter and let these young arms, these, you know, AJ Smith-Shawver, Hurston Waldrop, guys like that, just pitch in AAA for the remainder of the year, or do, you know, kind of what we've seen from a lot of good starters in the past, where like maybe Waldrop throws 2-3 innings out of the bullpen so he can get MLB experience and is a starter later, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's risk that spot isn't open for him. Whereas I think once the Marlins decide Max Meyer is up, I think he's up. I think the whole plan was to send him down to bring him up to finish the season in the big leagues. And I think Waldrop is getting an audition to have this job. But I think if there's any doubt that he can handle the job this year, not in the future, but this year, I think the Braves could easily go out and trade for a number 4 or 5 starter to round out their pitching staff. Which isn't even, I'm not even an Ian Anderson fan, so I'm not even saying like they're going to give Ian Anderson a chance, but they could also just give Ian Anderson a chance.
No, that's totally fair regarding the Braves. I in the short term, I don't even know what the Marlins are doing over there. And like, they have great pitching talent and I don't trust them to use it appropriately. Yes. They've already made me sad with Max Meyer this year. I do love Max Meyer though. He's great. All right. Good stuff. We're just going to move right in to our next debate, because I think we've kind of come to drawn that one to a conclusion. We're going to stick with pitching for a second, but we're going to move away from young starters to some middle relievers. In deeper leagues, finding reliable starting pitching can be harder than finding a needle in a haystack. If these three middle relievers were on your waiver wire, who would you take? And I'm just going to narrow it down to two. If you've got Jeremiah Estrada or Cade Smith as options on your waiver wire, who are you taking? And Eric, we'll start with you. Also, Jeremiah Estrada, let go by the Cubs, who could desperately use bullpen help. Just had to get that in there. Sorry, Eric, go ahead.
I was actually going to say, I was intrigued by Jeremiah Estrada back when he was with the Cubs. He was I know that Greg Jewett and those guys at Reliever Recon had mentioned him. I'm a stuffist out of the bullpen, right? Like, I want swings and misses. I want velocity. I want pitches that make me go, oh man. The velocity for Estrada is back up closer to what we saw in the, you know, his brief 2022 foray with the Cubs. A 34.6% strikeout minus walk ratio is pretty good. I think he has like three pitches that all grade out well with the splitter and the slider and the fastball. Good enough location for a reliever too. Like, you know, 99 location plus, 107 pitching plus. Like, those are solid marks for a reliever that throws hard and has multiple swing and miss pitches. So I like that just on the foundation of, hey, this is a guy who I think just is a solid pitcher who's going to get me swings and misses. And then I look at, like, if I'm choosing between these two guys, the closer that Smith pitches behind is just a touch more experience, just a little bit of a longer track record. And so I trust Class A like a little bit more than I trust Robert Suarez, who has been great this year. Like, you know, no knock on that at all. And then I also look at the Padres rotation and I'm just thinking, like, they're not guys that go deep into games. So I'm going to get lots of reliever innings on this team. They're, you know, granted, when Yu Darvish comes back, like, Darvish can go deep into games. He has. I don't know if we're getting Musgrove back or for, you know, Dylan Cease, like, he could go 5 innings or 8 innings, depending on the start. And then, like, Michael King, Matt Waldron, like, Adam Mazur, you know, these are not guys where you feel, even when King and Waldron are working, like they're not guys who are regularly going to go 7-8 innings. They're volatile starting pitchers. So I like the idea that I could get volume out of Estrada as well. Volume in terms of like repeated, you know, lots of opportunities for him to pitch, not that he's going to go like 3 innings at a time.
Yeah, good stuff. Shelley, what's your case for Cade Smith?
I will say that it's definitely Jeremiah Estrada for the win. Like I've picked him up pretty much everywhere and I'm loving like those 5-6 K weeks. It's delightful. But Cade Smith, in my opinion, kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, he was a relief prospect, you know, since he was drafted in 2021. I mean, he was a non-drafted free agent, actually, during that 2020 season. And, I mean, he's posted great numbers. But again, he was like a relief prospect and no one really talked about him. But he's been outstanding this year. 1.82 ERA, a 0.94 whip, 3 wins. Again, not too many. He has, what, 1 save? And he's probably, again, like Eric said, Class A is amazing. And he's back to his, you know, his top tier closer self after a kind of a shaky last season from like an ERA perspective. But I don't know. I like him. He's super cheap. Jeremiah Estrada kind of got like a little bit of a fab hike. You had to pay more than $1 for him. Like I picked up Cade Smith in some even deeper leagues for like $1. And I think that that's fine. Like, go with it. He like Estrada, can put up good ratios and put up like 3, 4, 5 Ks a week. And sometimes that's better than, you know, putting in, I don't know, Cal Quantrill on the road for a start, you know, like it could be better. So go for Cade Smith. He's the cheaper of the elite middle reliever strikeout guys. But yeah, just take a look at Cade Smith. He's really good.
Well, I'm actually going to start where you ended there, Shelley, with my question for Eric, because one of the things that I think about here is when you're looking at these middle relief guys, the value is sort of what you're looking for, right? So if you didn't, I drafted Matt Strom in a handful of places this season. I love that pick, but I also like, I would want to pick him up for $2. I wouldn't want to pick him up for $24. So is that value question when you're going for a guy like Estrada and you have to spend, you know, an order of magnitude more than you would on a Cade Smith, does that tilt the balance for you at all, Eric?
Yeah. If you're talking about two guys who I think should both be on rosters, then for sure. I don't, especially if like, I'm not looking at a guy like Estrada isn't Jeff Hoffman, where I'm thinking I'm also going to get a handful of saves this week. Like those guys, I'm willing to pay up for a little more because in addition to just being really good relievers who can give you lots of strikeouts and appear multiple times in a week, et cetera, they're like, I might get a save this week. And I'll, you know, that can add up over the course of the time. If we're just talking about these like non-save relief prospects who don't have like spec appeal, then sure. But I think the same case could have been made for Estrada. I'm sure that when Shelley picked him up in a lot of places, it wasn't for a lot of money because there were times where you could identify, I mean, he was lights out early on. And I think some people were like, well, he's not going to close. So, you know, what should I do about it? And so you're able to get him earlier on as opposed to right now. But listen, I think even the guy that was up for debate here, who we have yet to say his name, which is Reed Garrett, is a perfect example that like these guys come and go even as the season goes on, not even season two season. So if you missed out on Estrada, like sure, pick up Smith and then just keep your eyes out. Like what is Michael Tonkin doing with the Yankees right now? And why is he so valuable? He's been DFA'd 3 times this year, including twice in the same season by the Mets. And he's going over and like he picked up a save the other night and he's pitching high leverage outings for the Yankees. I mean, you saw last year when the Red Sox cut Ryan Brazier because he was terrible. And then he went to the Dodgers and he was like one of the best relievers in baseball. So I think if you miss on guys like this who are not save spec guys, try to get some, but also just keep an eye out for the next guy. And for me, that's leverage and strikeouts. Who's pitching higher leverage innings and who's getting strikeouts? And I think there's a chance that he's the next, you know, Jeremiah Estrada on the wire.
It's a really good point that these are guys that you want to be churning through. These are guys that you're picking up and dropping over and over again. Reed Garrett was the other name on the list. We were very enamored of Reed Garrett a couple of weeks ago, and that the bloom is off that rose a little bit. Shelley, how frequently are you churning on a roster slot like this? Like you mentioned picking up Cade Smith for a buck or two. Does he sit there for a week? Does he sit there for two? I do a similar move where I'm like, oh, I'm going to pick up Mark Leiter here. I'm going to pick up Yennier Cano or Daniel Colombe or whoever, right? Like just kind of trying to churn through some of those options. So what's the frequency of that churn for you?
Yeah, it's more of like a week by week basis. I take a look, see if like he's like totally like fallen off the cliff, or I don't know, maybe he only has 5 games this week. Maybe I'll just switch it out for someone who has 7 games and maybe I can pick up another 2 strikeouts or something like that. So yeah, it's definitely a churning thing, but it's definitely cheaper than like the save spec guy. Or honestly, like when I'm doing like a waterfall bid, I will put like these guys that I like under like that 2-start starter or this 1-start starter has a good start. And if I don't get them, oh, I'll just, you know, pick up Cade Smith and hopefully get a good ratios and 3 Ks during the week. And okay, that's fine. That helps me out a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm not even sure we need rebuttals here, because I feel like we've all kind of wound up at the same place here again. But these are useful pitchers, and they're probably doing more for you than, I don't know, whoever is closing for the Rockies at the moment that is going to get blown up at some point in time. I don't think that we let Eric tell his Rockies joke earlier. Take all of these guys over your Rockies, right? Yes.
Well, that it does tie back into the spec discussion that we had before, which is like when you're, or, you know, the not the spec as much as the punt discussion, where like what you're saying, hey, don't punt saves, try to pick up one or two. It's not grabbing Jalen Beeks or Tyler Kinley off waivers. It's, you know, taking a guy like Estrada while you're waiting to see what, if anything, shifts, because I'm getting a solid pitcher here. And if anything were to happen, then maybe he sneaks into a closer role. Or if I'm identifying a closer that I might want to pick up, I'm getting something of value. And why I say I want guys pitching high leverage innings, and you know, Fangraphs has a great way to look at leverage index, and because those are guys who could also steal you wins. If a guy isn't coming in to pitch in a game that is a close game, he's not going to get a win unless, you know, he pitched in the 5th inning of a game where the starter went 3 2/3 and the scorer decided like, hey, you get the win today, right? But we're not trying to rely on that. So like I want these guys who are coming in tight situations, you know, a guy who we don't even have on here, but like a Ryan Stanek from the Mariners, like he's pitching late in games, and you know, those guys can steal a save, can steal a win. And you know, if anything were to happen, they've already proven they can pitch at end of games.
Great stuff. We are going to take one more quick break for our sponsors. On the flip side, we have a couple of more debates. We have our love it or leave it. So come right back.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the 2-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you gotta check out NexGard Plus, ofoxaconazole, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease. Plus, it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive.
True or false? Walmart has eye care. True. Stop by Walmart to save and browse top designer frames right where you already shop. And they accept most insurance. Welcome to Easy Eye Care. Welcome to your Walmart.
All right, we are back. It looks like Eric is moderating our fifth debate, so I will pass it to you.
Yeah. Yeah, so I pleaded the fifth on this one, and I'm gonna let you two duke it out. So the fifth debate is about some young players who were drafted highly this spring who have been sent to the minor leagues. Obviously, there's a few that connect to that, but we want to look at three. And we asked, which player are you holding for long term? So it was a choice between Parker Meadows, Spencer Torkelson, or Reed Detmers. And Sarah, since you moderated the last one, let's let you get back in on the debate. And who would you pick of these three?
So to be clear, actually, I have similar concerns and similar hopes for all of these players. And I, given my druthers, the guy that I am actually holding because of some positional need that I have in some places is Spencer Torkelson. But I'm not going to make the case for Spencer Torkelson because that's a really specific situation where I need a first baseman to be a first baseman, and I don't really have great options to pick up to replace him. So I'm going to make the Reed Detmers case. And the reason I'm going to make the Reed Detmers case is because we have seen him recover before. So there's two things going on with Reed Detmers here that I think we should keep in mind. One is we've seen him excel and we've seen him struggle, and then we've seen him come back and excel. I think that's really important here because a lot of what we're seeing with all three of these players is that they're young guys who are in the major leagues and they're struggling against the competition that they're facing. We don't actually know how Torkelson or Meadows is going to bounce back from that or what AAA is hoping to fix. We have a pretty good idea of what Reed Detmers is trying to work on and what he's trying to fix. And then the tiebreaker here for me is really just, I have, looking at the Angels' options and looking at what they need, it strikes me as likely that Detmers, if he figures out what he needs to figure out in the next 3 or 4 weeks, he's coming back. He has a rotation spot. They want him to be the guy that he was when he was pitching out of his mind in April, the last time we talked about him. And we have seen him recover that in the past. So I'm going to bank on past performance and say that I'm going to hold on to Reed Detmers rather than try to like drop him and try to stream somebody who I think is going to be a worse pitcher when he comes back. That said, I really want Torkelson to figure it out because I need him in one of my most important leagues right now.
Shelley?
Yeah, I'm going to make the case for Torque. Number one, he has a Frenchie, so he automatically gets, I will automatically just love him just for that. Mm-hmm. But number two, he's hitting extremely well in AAA. Again, it's AAA. We all know that the pitching isn't that great, but he's hitting 333, 429, 583. He's only striking out 18% of the time, which is great. While the slug looks pretty good, it's more doubles instead of homers. And I mean, I think that is one thing about Torque that's probably always going to be a bugaboo for him. He hits in a cavernous ballpark, but we did see him last year get those home runs that we desperately need in this, you know, powerless, you know, fantasy baseball environment. So if there is a guy, you know, any of the three guys that we mentioned that I would bank on, it would be Torque finding it out. And plus, the Tigers need some type of offensive juice. So if they get him right, they'll bring him back up. He's a 1-1 pick. They're not going to give up on that dude. So I kept him in a couple of leagues. Hopefully it works out for me. And I dropped Detmers. So I don't know. This is a real life debate situation that I'm taking with my league. So, oh boy.
Okay. Well, let's get into some questions from me. Sarah, start with you. Does the amount of stopping and starting we've seen with Detmers impact your ability, your desire to hold, in the fact that, like, the Spencer Torkelson of it all is he's basically only had one poor season, right? He started last year. We have the success from last year. It didn't work out this year. They sent him down. Detmers has flashed, fallen back. Does that make you feel less confident that he can actually figure it out?
It actually makes me feel more confident because we know that he has figured it out in the past. Now, the problem that Detmers has is he doesn't figure it out for very long, right? So I feel like there's enough time in the season that Detmers is going to figure it out again. He's going to come up and have, I don't know, a nice August or something like that, a really great July. And I want to be there when that happens. Looking at what went on with him in terms of his splits, really wild. Like he super fell off the planet there, and his strikeouts rate just collapsed. And I can't tell exactly what the mechanics of that are, but it makes me wonder if he's tipping pitches or if he is doing something the batters see differently, or if he's getting a lot of hard hits on certain types of pitches. And that's a mechanical tweak that it strikes me as the type of thing he's worked on before, and he'll do it again. Now, if we get to the end of August and Reed Detmers is struggling again, I'm definitely going to drop him because I'm probably not going to pick him up next season at the draft capital that he's going to go for, because we have seen this back and forth before. But there's enough time left in the season. He can work on a mechanical fix and fix it. The fall off was so complete that I don't think it's anything with him as he has forgotten how to pitch. I think that there's something mechanical that they can fix in AAA.
Follow-up question for Shelley is, given that so much of Torkelson's value is on home runs, because the batting average, even in his good season last year, was low, as of right now, the team context is improving but not great, so runs and RBIs counting stats are going to be iffy. Does that make it a harder tightrope for him to walk? Because if he, as we saw at the beginning of this year, is not hitting as many home runs as we expect because of the way pitchers are changing him, because he's trying to lift the ball, whatever it might be, that seems to maybe ding him a little bit more because it's really his one carrying skill.
Yeah, it does scare me, but he does play on the road. So I'm hoping on that. I'm hoping he gets back to the guy that he was. Again, he's kind of like a mini Kyle Schwarber. Like, he's going to hit home runs. The average is going to be poopy. Don't look at that. Shield your eyes. But I'm just hoping for any type of home run juice. I need home runs in pretty much every single league that I play in. So if any guy can give me at least 25, 30 home run full season, like, projection, I will hold on to that and just, you know, hold my nose, and hopefully he'll get back to that groove that he was in the second half of last year.
All right. Sarah, do you have a rebuttal you want to ask?
Yeah, I do. And this is my only concern with Torkelson. I really hope I'm wrong. The offensive environment this year looks different than it did last year. Now, admittedly, that could be the weather. It could be all sorts of different things. We know that MLB loves to do all their shenanigans with the literal baseball to make it really hard for us to predict anything. Because we only have the one season, and really it's one half of a season where Torkelson was a masher, I do worry, particularly with that park, that could wind up just being an outlier, right? That someday far into the future, we're going to be having this conversation. We're going to refer to 2024 as a dead ball year. And, like, look at all the guys who lost all of their home runs or whatever, or we'll refer to 2023 as a year where a guy got a boost for whatever reason. So part of what gives me confidence with Detmers is that we've seen him go up, we've seen him go down. That likely means that he's going to be able to go up again sometime this season, and I'll hold on for that. I don't know that we've seen the backup from Torque. Like, what if this is just the one outlier situation where he got really lucky. And that was just a really great 2 month stretch. And now we're not going to see it anymore. So that's my concern with him. That said, I am holding Torkelson in places. I would not be holding Parker Meadows, who was the other player that we were going to talk about here, even though I love him and he's also doing really well at AAA and I want good things for him. I have more faith in Torkelson and Detmers than I do in Meadows.
Shelley, you have a rebuttal?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we'll see like Torkelson do like a Reed Detmers and come up after AAA and go gangbusters. So maybe they're just doing opposite little things here. So, you know, I'll just bank on the power. In some of my shallower leagues, I don't necessarily need pitching. I need home runs. So I'm just going to go with, I will stash someone that I know I need stats from versus a guy who I could maybe try to do a stream thing. So yeah, just give me Torque.
Yeah. I will say I've weighed in on the Torkelson debate online prior to the demotion. I think the narrative of like, he did this last year, he could do it again. Like, that's not to say it's what either one of you two mentioned, but I've just cautioned people of thinking, hey, he did this before, he could do it again, which was a lot of the defense of Torkelson before he was sent down was he started slow last year, he'll do it again. Mm-hmm. I think that we're maybe that allows us to not identify some of the actual issues. I know the called strike rate is up this year. He's been a little more passive. I notice on the great pitcher list player pages where you can look at where hitters are being pitched too. He's being pitched up in the zone way more than last year, and he's being pitched inside way more than last year. If you go look at like Statcast run values, he has a hole in his swing middle in, and he has holes in his swing in terms of like where the run values are up and away. And that has led to like a pretty drastic increase in pop-up rate. I don't know that it's just, hey, this is a guy trying to jack everything out of the park. I think it's also like pitchers said, hey, we've identified you maybe struggle at these spots because you're so power dependent. And I don't know that he's necessarily adjusting as quickly as maybe the Tigers hoped. So I would have picked Detmers here because I have some concerns about Torkelson's ability to hit more than like say 25 home runs unless he shifts and adjusts back to what pitches are doing to him.
That's good stuff. I mean, those adjustments when you're a young batter or a young pitcher for that matter are so important, and the league is constantly shifting according to what you have done, and being able to make that move back is super important. We have one last debate, then we're going to go into our love it or leave it. I think I've got the moderating duties here. So to set this up, over the last 30 days, two of our most highly touted outfielders from the preseason have really struggled. Corbin Carroll has earned a dollar in value on the Fangraphs player rater, while Michael Harris II has lost $1.10 per that same player rater. You got to pick one of these guys to stick with for the rest of the season. And Eric, as our guest, we'll start with you. Who you got, Carroll or Harris?
I'm taking Harris. And I just don't think Carroll is healthy. That's point blank what it comes down to. I know that he's said his shoulder isn't an issue and that a lot of his lack of power is because of the swing plane. But what he's explaining and why he changed the swing plane, as somebody, as a former hitter, to me, it's a swing plane that you change because it feels better on your shoulder. Finishing flatter so that your arm doesn't extend as much over your shoulder and your follow through puts a lot less strain on your shoulder. So what he has done to his swing may have been subconscious, but it strikes me as something that you do to counter pain in your shoulder, which we know he had last year. We're not like making up an injury. We know he had shoulder injuries in the past. We know he had shoulder injuries last year. We know there was no procedure done on it. I don't feel confident that this is a guy who is healthy, which means I don't feel confident you're going to get much power from him. And so I'm picking Harris mainly because I feel like he is the guy who is healthy. And I still think like you're going to get your 20 plus stolen bases out of him. I look at, you know, Austin Riley, like these are guys who are running really low homer to fly ball rates, that I kind of have to feel like have to regress to the mean like a little bit. His max exit velocity this year is harder than anything he's hit in the past. So it's not like he lost pop. It's not like he lost the ability to hit it hard. He's not hitting it hard in the air as he did in the past. You look at like ground ball rate, you know, to fly ball rate, like it's pretty even. He's pulling the ball far more this year. That could be a little bit of an issue where maybe his approach is getting too pull happy and he needs to adjust. The contact rates are still good. You know, I don't see anything drastic other than I think like his chase rate is a little high and his pull rate is a little high, which suggests to me he might be swinging at things that are, you know, not ideal and maybe being a little more aggressive outside of the zone than he needs to be. But we've seen him have some cold stretches and adjust before. This is a high batting average hitter. And even in his struggles, he's hitting 250, which is significantly higher than Corbin Carroll. So I'll take Michael Harris right now.
All right, Shelley, what's your case for Corbin Carroll?
Yeah, it's not great what Corbin Carroll is doing. I mean, he has a 0.086 ISO. So yes, I do agree that, yeah, I don't think that he's healthy. Everything that he says, I mean, I really want to trust the player, but like Eric says, whenever you are feeling something, like I know whenever I do exercises, when I'm feeling something, I might do like a specific weight thing differently, and then I will hurt later. Like it just, anyway. But Corbin Carroll, he has a career low 249 BABIP. Just based on his speed, that doesn't make sense. Obviously, it depends on where you're hitting it. Like, is he pulling ground balls? There are some things that he's probably doing that is contributing to that low BABIP, but it still seems extremely unlucky for him to have that low of a BABIP. And even though his batting average is awful, it's 204. He has 2 home runs, which not that great, but he still has 11 stolen bases. And he is continuously pretty much playing every day. They have set him against like more difficult pitchers because he's not playing well and they're trying to win games. But he's still playing every day. So he must not be telling the team that he's hurting or whatever, but he's still giving you stolen bases. And maybe he'll get to like 5 home runs this year, but he's playing every day. I'm hoping for the BABIP bounce in the second half. Again, it's not going to be what he did last year, but if I had to pick one, I'm going to be stubborn and stick with the guy who I drafted way too much in Corbin Carroll.
Shelley, I have a question to start with for you, and I hear you on Carroll. I love the skill set. Like, I really enjoyed watching him play last year. I think the thing that makes me most nervous about Carroll is that some of these, if you go back to when the shoulder injury that we all saw at the plate occurred, some of these trends date back into last season. Casey, Bubba, and I were trying to work out a trade in Towers right when he like hurt his shoulder at the plate. And it was supposed to be his Corbin Carroll for my Spencer Strider straight up because of what both of us needed and where we were at. And I think that's a remarkably fair deal. And I got nervous and pulled the plug on it when I saw Corbin Carroll was hurt and then we never came back to it. I'm curious, does it worry you that it goes back to last season?
Oh, totally. Yeah. And it kind of concerns me that the team hasn't done anything and he hasn't done anything. So it's really an odd thing that no one, like, they're still letting him play. But that being said, I still believe in the player. Like last year, just watching him, he just looks like so mature. And he just looked like he owned that dugout. Like everyone, he just brought the team together. And, you know, they made a World Series run, which was great. So I believe in the guy. Like, I really do. And again, maybe it's going to hurt me in my fantasy leagues. But I believe, like, if when he says he's not hurt, like, I can't say that, oh, no, you're hurt because you're bad. That kind of is like, well, that seems kind of wrong.
Totally reasonable. Eric, I want to talk about this Michael Harris situation for 1 second, because one of the things that I've heard some other great podcasters and friends of ours talk about on the show. And I'm thinking specifically of Rates and Barrels with Derek Van Riper and, you know, Sarah's right at the moment, but is that the Braves are being pitched differently than they have been previously. And that has led to a lot of their hitters struggling. Right. And so this is not an isolated struggle for Harris. It's like a team wide, everybody except Marcell Ozuna searching for some meaning over in Atlanta there. Does it worry you that this is maybe not something he can hit his way out of, that this is going to take a longer time for them to adjust as a team? I watched something similar happen to the Cubs in like 2018 and 2019, and it reminds me a little bit of that. Obviously, the Braves are much better.
So, no, but I think that could be stubbornness on my part, but it goes back to what you were saying when you sided with Waldrop, is like trusting an organization. You know, the Braves have proven to be a really well-run organization in the past. And so if they are indeed being pitched differently and it is impacting, you know, their hitters, I trust that that's an organization that understands that that's what's going on and can adjust back to it. And so it's like, is this happening? Okay, smart people are saying it's happening. Is the organization able to identify and map out a strategy to combat it? I do believe in this case, the Braves are that organization. Is the hitter talented enough to implement that strategy and make adjustments to combat what's being done? I think Michael Harris has proven in his minor league and major league career that he can make those adjustments. Maybe it won't lead to the level of power that we've seen, but like, this is a guy who's struggling and hitting 250. If he ended the season hitting 275, 280, I don't know that it would shock any of us, and he still could easily have his 20 stolen bases. And so I just feel like, for me, this is a floor issue, where the floor for Carroll, for me, is so low because it's health related to in my head. And again, I want to say that like, nobody within the Diamondbacks organization or Corbin Carroll himself has said that he is hurt. So I am taking what happened last year and my own understanding of swings and swing mechanics, and I am putting that onto this. And so I could totally be wrong, but to me, that's where the floor is for me, is I just don't think he's right. And so if you ask me to pick one for the rest of the season, I'm picking Harris because I feel better about him even just being a league average player for the full remainder of the year.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And I hear you on the floor and ceiling issue for sure. Let's move to our last rebuttals for today's debates. Shelley, you get our first rebuttal. What say you in defense of Corbin Carroll?
Everything that I said about Corbin Carroll, I totally disagree with. I totally agree with Eric completely. I am super scared about Carroll as well. I love the dude. There is a chance. I mean, the BABIP thing, I know, I hate to go to like, what, 2000, you know, sabermetric stuff. Oh, the BABIP's low, he's unlucky. Kind of, you know, bull malarkey stuff. But it is low. So I'm banking on that. But I agree that there is something going on with Carroll, whether it's mechanics, health, both, anything. Yes, there is something going on with Corbin Carroll. I hope he gets back right next year.
All right. So it seems like we agree now. Eric, would you like to finish our debate here, or are you?
No, I would just say that, you know, the case for Carroll is, if we even just say, hey, forget it, he's not going to hit for power, but that average goes back up to 240, 250 because he stops trying to do anything but hit ground balls and line drives. I mean, the speed is an elite tool. And so if there's a chance that he, you know, even steals like, you know, 30 plus bases, pushes 40 bases, winds up hitting 240 at the end of the year, like there's an argument that that winds up being more valuable than a slightly diminished Michael Harris. And so there is a world where Corbin Carroll with no power is still more valuable, but it has to come with the batting average that Shelley's talking about, which then has to lead to the stolen bases, because the stolen base upside he has is the most elite of the five category production you're going to get from either of these two guys.
All right. Great stuff, as always, in these debates. Eric, thank you so much for joining us today. Remind people before we head to our Love It or Leave It, the way we always end the show, where people can find you and your work.
Sure. So every Monday, Nick and I record every Monday. So every Tuesday, the On the Corner, or late Monday night, the On the Corner podcast comes out. You can check me out there with Nick Pollock. I also host the Roto-World Fantasy Baseball Show, which is on Mondays and Wednesdays with Scott Pianowski, who's over at Yahoo Sports. And so you can check that out wherever you get your podcasts. And then I write my content over at NBC Sports. Every Wednesday, I have an article called Mixing It Up, where I look at pitch mix changes from various pitchers. Tomorrow's article will be all of these rookie pitchers. So I'll be looking at the pitch mixes of Waldrop and Drew Thorpe, who's starting like right now, and Cade Povich, and also Mitch Spence, who is not as sexy but is a rookie pitcher and is pitching well, and so he gets into the article. So you can check all of that out over on NBC Sports as well.
Awesome, good stuff. As our guest, you get our first Love It or Leave It. What's one thing from baseball news this week that you're super into or over?
I'm super over the Garrett Stubbs slide at home plate in the London series. Full disclosure, I mean, as anybody who follows my work knows, I was a catcher in college. I will always side with my catchers. I understand Garrett Stubbs is also a catcher, but in this case, I'm looking at defensively speaking. I think a lot of rules have been put in place about what catchers are able to do at plays at the plate. A lot of the rules about blocking the plate while you're actually catching a throw and trying to make a play at home, I think they have led to a lot of subjective calls that are making it tough for catchers to actually make plays at the plate while abiding by whatever the rules and regulations are. And so to me, I thought it was pretty gross that Torrens makes this play at the plate where Stubbs is tagged out. It's a forced out. Stubbs is forced out before he even started his slide. Torrens turns to first base. I understand that as he turned and made the throw, he is covering most of home plate. But there, if Stubbs had really been sliding for home plate, there was a path for him. But again, he was tagged out, or he was forced out before he even started his slide. And the slide itself is very clearly a takeout of Torrens. He almost is like leg whipping him, not really trying to get to the plate on a catcher who's not even looking at him. And so I thought the fact that all these rules have been put in place that make it harder for catchers to defend the plate, and nobody is talking about this catcher being just taken out on a play that wasn't even a play at the plate because the play had already been made, is pretty egregious to me. And I know that people are like, oh, well, baseball players are taught to break up double plays. Well, yeah, but they also put in place rules where you can't slide at the defender anymore. You need to slide within the base path. You can't slide through the bag. You can't slide out of the base path to make contact. And that slide is 100% designed to make contact with Luis Torrens. It was not a slide designed to get to home plate. And so had that happened at second base, I think it would have also looked dirty and more people would have been up in arms about it. And I think maybe we're not up in arms about it because it was a great play and it ended a game and a lovely British guy was calling it and it made it sound awesome. But I think it deserves a little bit more scorn than we're giving it.
That's a great point. And that is why the rule exists. I agree with you also that Brits call in baseball is really just lovely to listen to. And yeah, I think that we need to make sure that all the rules that protect players are being used. Are being used fairly because nobody wants to see guys get hurt. Mm-hmm. Shelley, what are you up to right now? And what's your Love It or Leave It this week?
Yeah, I'm just going to just jump into my Love It or Leave It. I'm going to be positive this week. It's Cosmic Baseball. I don't know if y'all saw this, but it's baseball played under blacklight, which is amazing. But come to find out, it's like an hour away from where I live. And I feel so dumb. Because I saw it, like, I'm like, oh, that's cool. I never thought that it would be an hour away from Richmond, Virginia. And now all the tickets for, they do it like once a month. Now all the tickets are sold out, so I can't go. So I'm a little bummed. But I just think it's like a really cool thing. The Savannah Bananas thing is pretty cool. Like they're doing like a nationwide tour. It's really fun. But this one is just like really cool with like the you know, the black light, the bright colors. Oh, it's really, really cool. And just bringing, you know, baseball back to like Colonial Heights, Virginia, which if anyone on this podcast who is listening who knows about Colonial Heights, Virginia, hi, I know, I probably know you, but just bringing baseball to communities that small is really awesome. And now they're getting even more publicity and probably more money, and maybe it'll bring in more fans and just more baseball fans. So I don't know. I thought it was like really cool. I love when small town teams do stuff like this.
I think it looked amazing. When you shared the link in the show notes, I was just like, this is the coolest thing. I've never seen anything like this. And I will make sure to include the link in the show notes here so other people can click on it and see it when you're listening to the podcast, because I didn't know anything about this. It's so rad.
Yeah. Yeah.
My love it or leave it this week, it's baseball adjacent. So forgive me for not having a truly baseball thing. But on Saturday, I got to go to see the Chicago Red Stars, which is the National Women's Soccer League team in Chicago, play at Wrigley Field for the first time ever. And that came about because one of the Ricketts siblings, who is involved in the ownership group with the Cubs, also is involved in the ownership group with the Red Stars and made that happen. It was the largest crowd ever to watch a women's soccer game. It was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had in my life. It was so amazing to see some really great players play. Mallory Swanson, who is married to Dansby Swanson, obviously like star of the show. And then of course, Alyssa Nair is the goalie for the Red Stars and has been the goalie previously for the U.S. Women's National Team. It was just a lot of fun. If you've not been to a women's sporting event, you should go. They're fun. And it was really cool to see that played at a venue like Wrigley Field and to see how many people from Chicago showed up.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, Eric, thank you one more time for joining us. Remind people of your Twitter handle. And yeah, thanks for joining us for some debates.
Thanks for having me. I am a New Yorker, so I love a debate. So I'm happy to be here for this. You can follow me on Twitter at SamskyNYC. And I do tweet out all my work and videos and links and stuff. So if you want to check out what I'm doing, that is always the best place to find it.
Good stuff. And yes, we're still calling it Twitter. Shelley, remind people where they can find you on what we're still calling Twitter.
You can find me at ShelleyV_643. I don't know. Maybe I can find some resale tickets to go see the Tri-City team.
Good stuff. And you can find me at BCB_Sarah. We'll be back next week with all of the fantasy baseball debates that are driving your decisions this week.
NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. If approved, applications are typically funded the next business day or sooner. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you gotta check out NexGard Plus, Afoxolaner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel Chewable Tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease, plus it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus Chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive.